Pacifica. This is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting live from Copenhagen. It's Climate Countdown.
Our goal this week is to get all the support we can behind the most vulnerable poor nations in the planet. They're showing unbelievable courage in sticking up against the pressure from the U.S. and others to just cut a deal and go away.
Bill McKibben, the founder of 350.org, joins us to talk about the UN climate talks, the widening divide between rich and poor nations, and the power of protest. We'll also speak with Kenyan global justice activist Wahu Kara. Then, who provides the U.S. with the most oil? Canada. That's right. It comes from the Alberta tar sands, described as the world's biggest single industrial source of carbon emissions. Indigenous people marched this week on the Canadian embassy in Copenhagen.
The Alberta tar sands are not only destroying my people and my land, but they are creating the largest CO2 emissions from one single project in the world at the cost of my family, my community, my culture, my way of life is being destroyed.
At the heart of the Obama administration's effort to reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions is a market-based system to trade carbon known as cap and trade.
The latest bubble just burst, and now they have a new idea for a market, trading carbon pollution. They're about to develop a new $3 trillion bubble. But when this one bursts, it won't just take down our stock portfolios, it could take down everything.
Today, we'll host a debate on cap and trade, all that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting live from Copenhagen. Negotiations have resumed at the Copenhagen Climate Summit following Monday's walkout by developing countries. The African-led protests centered around concerns richer nations are trying to kill the Kyoto Protocol by merging it with a separate negotiating track. Kamal Djoumoi, the chair of the African bloc, said poorer countries would never accept the abandonment of Kyoto.
The Kyoto Protocol took 7 years to enter into force. The next treaty, I'm sure that it will take more than that, even if there will be a political will. Because this process missed and lost all confidence and the main transparency in it from the most developing countries.
The dispute was resolved with an agreement to resume informal talks along separate tracks. Meanwhile, outside the summit, Danish police are intensifying their crackdown on climate justice activists. Late last night, riot police raided Copenhagen's autonomous community of Christiania as it played host to a party organized by protest groups. Witnesses say police fired tear gas directly at the party as attendees were dancing and gathering inside. Some protesters were said to have thrown bottles at police and set fire to barricades. More than 200 people were reportedly arrested. The Christiania raid comes ahead of a massive act of civil disobedience planned for Wednesday. Organizers of the Reclaim Power action say they'll disrupt the summit and hold a people's assembly giving voice to those calling for climate justice. We'll have more from Copenhagen after headlines. In healthcare news, independent Senator Joseph Lieberman appears to have successfully derailed the latest Senate Democratic health care proposal. Last week, Democrats reached agreement on a so-called compromise to abandon the public insurance option but expand Medicare by lowering the age of eligibility to 55. Lieberman had previously said he supported Medicare expansion. But on Sunday, Lieberman surprised Democrats and announced he would now oppose the measure unless both the Medicare provision and any form of government-backed insurance plan were excluded. On Monday, Lieberman emerged from a meeting with top White House officials and Democratic senators to say he's, quote, encouraged his demands will be met. President Obama met with top financial executives at the White House Monday in what he called an effort to encourage lending to struggling Americans. The White House says Obama asked for more loans to small businesses and homeowners and support for a congressional overhaul of financial regulation.
Given the difficulty business people are having as lending has declined, and given the exceptional assistance banks received to get them through a difficult time, we expect them to explore every responsible way to help get our economy moving again. If they wish to fight common sense consumer protections, That's a fight I'm more than willing to
Obama's
have.
Obama's call comes as a number of bailed out firms continue to repay their taxpayer loans. On Monday, Citibank and Wells Fargo said they're moving ahead with repayments, which would help them reject government demands. In what some called an illustration of the government's weakened position, the CEOs of the three largest bailed out firms, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Citigroup, did not attend the meeting. They'd waited until Monday to travel to Washington, but weather problems delayed their planes. The meeting was held as new figures showed CEOs of the top 10 failed or bailed out Wall Street firms were paid an average $28.9 million in the years leading up to the nation's financial meltdown. According to Public Citizen, the executives' average pay this decade amounts to 575 times the median income for U.S. families. Meanwhile, in New York, hundreds of protesters marched on the offices of the banking giant J.P. Morgan Chase to demand better treatment of customers facing foreclosure. Darren Duarte of the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, known as NACA, said Chase's policies are throwing homeowners out onto the streets.
It's Christmas time, people are being thrown out in the streets, and I think bankers could do more. The president is talking a lot about it, but he's not requiring them or taking action. We wanted to take action today.
The protest was held as part of NACA's Save the Dream Tour to pressure banks to restructure mortgages. The group says over 350,000 people have taken part in 11 cities nationwide. In Pakistan, the U.S. is reportedly considering expanding drone attacks beyond tribal areas into the major city of Quetta. The Los Angeles Times reports senior U.S. officials have argued in favor of launching or threatening the attacks as a means to pressure the Pakistani government to crack down on Taliban leaders. Quetta has a population of 850,000. The Iranian government has announced plans to try three Americans detained after mistakenly hiking into Iran earlier this year. It's unclear when the trial will begin or what charges will be applied. Last month, an Iranian prosecutor accused the three of espionage. On Monday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton rejected Iran's charges.
The three young people who were detained by the Iranians have absolutely no connection with any kind of action against the Iranian state or government. In fact, they were out hiking and unfortunately, apparently, allegedly, walked across an unmarked boundary. We appeal to the Iranian leadership to release these three young people and free them as soon as possible.
Iran's announcement comes days after it called on the U.S. to release 11 Iranian citizens it says are jailed in U.S. prisons. The United Nations peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo is being accused of complicity in the killings of hundreds of innocent civilians. In a new report, Human Rights Watch says the UN mission has abetted the killings of at least 1,400 civilians and a number of rapes. The report calls on the UN to immediately suspend its collaboration with the Congolese army. In Britain, former Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni has canceled a scheduled visit after a British court issued a warrant for her arrest. The warrant cited Livni's role in the U.S.-backed Israeli attack on Gaza nearly a year ago that killed over 1,300 Palestinians, most of them civilians. It's the first time a British court has issued a warrant against a sitting or former Israeli minister. The warrant was rescinded after the court determined Livni would not be visiting Britain. Chile is headed to a runoff vote after Sunday's presidential election failed to produce a clear winner. Right-wing billionaire Sebastián Piñera came out ahead with 44% of the vote. He'll face off against former Chilean president Eduardo Frei in a second round next month. Back in the United States, several anti-war groups have formed a new coalition to oppose the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and other U.S. military actions abroad. The group End U.S. Wars held an inaugural rally Saturday in front of the White House. Democratic Congressmember Dennis Kucinich was among those to address the crowd.
We have money for war, but not for jobs. Jeez. Money for war, but not for health care. Money for war, but not for education. Money for war, but not for housing. Money for war, but not for peace. Billions for bailouts, bonuses, and bombs.
The Supreme Court has refused to review a lower court's dismissal of a suit against former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other top U.S. military officials for the torture of four former Guantanamo prisoners. Last year, the D.C. Circuit Court ruled the four have no constitutional rights and don't qualify as persons under the law. The Obama administration had asked the Supreme Court to reject the appeal. The lead attorney in the case, Eric Lewis, said, quote, "The final word on whether these men had a right not to be tortured or a right to practice their religion free from abuse is that they did not. Future prospective torturers can now draw comfort," he said. And a Canadian activist has been barred from entering the United States to speak out against the upcoming Winter Olympics in Vancouver. On Friday, Marla Wren of the Olympic Resistance Network said she was detained and interrogated for 6 hours before being returned to Canada.
When I arrived at the American border, I was picked out of the line before I reached my turn to step up to the wicket. And I was questioned specifically about what I was going to be doing in Portland, and then questioned quite extensively about who I knew there and the purposes of why I was going to be there. I was subsequently refused entry based on the fact that I haven't been employed for the last 3 months.
Local activists have criticized the Vancouver Olympics for displacing and sidelining low-income residents, as well as infringing on Indigenous land rights. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. This is Climate Countdown.
We are watching you. You know what to do. The number has been set. Pay your climate.
We are seeing a redefinition of environmentalism.
Resist, mobilize, transform.
Well, I think the fact that we're talking here about very significant money.
We are suffering the most, but we have not caused the problem in the least. So for us, it's a justice issue. It is also a human rights issue.
Watching you. You know
most speakers
to
who took part in the discussion today emphasized the importance of the Kyoto Protocol.
1.5 degrees, that's enough for our little island in the Pacific to drown. So people, wake up. Climate change is real.
It's a hard rain that's gonna fall.
This is Climate Countdown. Bob Dylan's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall is the unofficial anthem of the COP15 conference here in Copenhagen. Yes, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. And we're broadcasting from inside the Bella Center, what some might call the Bella of the Beast, in this exclusive two-week series on the Climate Summit. Negotiations are back on track here at the summit after a walkout yesterday by developing countries highlighted the growing divide between rich and poor nations. African delegates led the walkout, accusing the UN chair of the conference of trying to kill the Kyoto Protocol by merging it with a separate negotiating track on a new agreement. Kyoto is the only legal treaty that requires rich nations to slash their greenhouse gas emissions. In a victory for developing nations, it was agreed after several hours that informal talks would proceed along two parallel tracks. Meanwhile, a group of more than 50 non-governmental organizations are accusing the UN of undemocratic behavior for not letting in thousands of NGO representatives into the Bella Center to attend the summit. On Monday, thousands of people already registered to attend waited in line for hours before being turned away. The number of NGO representatives allowed in will be limited to 7,000 on Tuesday and Wednesday, falling to 1,000 on Thursday, and just 90 on Friday, as more than 110 heads of state arrive for the talks. Meanwhile, outside the Bella Center, Danish police are intensifying their crackdown on climate justice activists. Late last night, riot police raided Copenhagen's autonomous community of Christiania as it played host to a party organized by protest groups. More than 200 people were reportedly arrested. This follows the arrest of some 1,200 people over the weekend. That was amidst a march of 100,000 people in Copenhagen. Bill McKibben was among those marching at the mass protest on Saturday. He is the co-founder and director of 350.org. 20 years ago, he published The End of Nature, the first general audience book about global warming. We're also joined by the Kenyan global justice activist Wahu Kara, and we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Bill, talk about what's happening inside before we talk about major protests planned for tomorrow once again.
Most of what's happening inside we could have predicted. There's no agreement in sight. Everything's up in the air. Everybody's waiting for heads of state to arrive and cut a deal. The one thing we couldn't have predicted a few months ago was just how strong and how courageous poor nations, small nations, vulnerable nations are being here. They're under intense pressure, and yet they're standing up to it so far with great courage. The flashpoint, really, has been this number 350. About 100 delegations now have endorsed that target and are trying very hard to get it put back into the main text where it was taken
out. And explain what 350 means, what's written down your tie right now.
350 is the most important number in the world, though we didn't know it 2 years ago. It's what scientists tell us is the most carbon we can have in the atmosphere if we want a world that works. We're already at 390 parts per million CO2. That's why the Arctic is melting. That's why Africa is drying up. And it's why we need this conference to be treating this not as another problem to be dealt with in some incremental, easy fashion, but as the emergency that it is.
And do you have that sense? You're from the United States. Do you have that sense among the U.S. delegation, which is being called the key obstructionist country here?
No. The U.S. the Obama administration has committed very little political capital to this. The offer that they've put on the table, 4% reductions from 1990 levels of carbon by 2020, is less than the agreement, less than the amount we agreed to cut in Kyoto a dozen years ago. It's a pathetic offer, but it reflects just how little political attention the administration's been willing to pay for it. They're hiding behind the skirts of the Senate, saying, oh, we couldn't get anything more ambitious through the Senate, but they haven't made any effort to do it.
The Senate, there are several bills now. Explain the difference from cap and trade to cap and dividend. I think it makes people's eyes glaze over. Already, global warming presented in the United States is still a debate whether it is human-made.
So we're going to have to cap carbon if we're ever going to deal with this climate crisis. We're going to have to cap carbon and bring down the amount we produce. That's going to make carbon more valuable. It's going to make fossil fuel more expensive. There are many ways that you could go about doing this. The way that the main bill, the Waxman, Markey, Kerry, Boxer, Lieberman, Graham bill, whatever,
and
does
it. And I should say, in 1 hour after this broadcast, Senator Kerry is going to be speaking right here. In fact, for the Democracy Now! Viewers who watch on television right through this glass, in a few minutes, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, is going to be speaking here. But yes, the Kerry, Boxer, et cetera bill.
That's the effort to, in essence, cap carbon and round up 60 votes by giving everybody a little piece of the action, every interest group a little piece of the action, some serious money for nukes, for clean coal, for whatever, kind of buying votes one at a time. It's one tactic, but it's a pretty messy and ugly process. And it's not at all clear with the number of loopholes in that bill how much it would accomplish. This other bill introduced last week by Senator Cantwell and Senator Collins is, in its architecture, more interesting. It would take the fees to put carbon in the atmosphere directly from, say, ExxonMobil at the very top of the stream, and return them every month via a check to every person in the U.S. Your price at the pump would go up as Exxon paid off the cost of this permit to produce carbon, but you'd be getting the check to make you whole every month. It's a kind of interesting architecture, and there's, I think, some hope that if it had strong targets attached to it, it could do pretty interesting things.
Wahu Kara, as you listen to what's going on in the United States, from where you live in Kenya, why are you here, and what are you hoping will be accomplished this week?
I am here because it's important for the kind of work I work in organizing and mobilizing social movements for social agency in transformation to come here and link up with others. And that's why much of my work has been at Klima Forum. However, I'm also here at Bella Center because it's also important to follow up what is happening, even if I find that not so much will be done like the African people expressed yesterday. But we have to be here because the world belongs to us, and we are the people who have alternatives. We are the people to continue reminding the policymakers that we do not have any more time for negotiations, and in particular us from the South, because the more they negotiate, the more we die, and every life is valuable. So for us who are very much interested in the question of the dignity of human life and human dignity and self-determination and human progress and prosperity, where we are convinced each and every global citizen has a right to participate in making that human prosperity. That's why I'm here.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. And I want to ask you how you move from working on debt issues around poverty to climate debt and how they're connected. Our guests are Wahu Kara. She is a Kenyan global justice activist. She'll be one of those on the outside tomorrow in a major Reclaim Power protest. Bill McKibben is with us. He's inside and outside the Bella Center as well, co-founder and director of 350.org. After we speak with them, we're going to go to the tar sands in Alberta and learn about where the United States gets most of its oil. And finally, a debate on cap and trade. Stay with us.
Rain, I love the smell of the rain. Rain, rain in my face, and I'm running in place, and I'm loving the smell of the sun. I love the warmth of the sun on my nose, and the sun shine on my clothes, and I'm loving the warmth of the
wind.
I love the rush of the wind in my hair as I dancing in air, and I'm loving the rush of the
sand. I love the crunch of the sand in my toes, and the sand dunes marching in rows. Oh, I'm loving the crunch of the
sea. I love the dance of the sea, swimming so fearless and free, floating and diving. I'm loving the dance of the stars.
Nature song, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. This is Climate Countdown. We're broadcasting live from Copenhagen, exclusively the 2 weeks, the only daily global TV, radio, internet broadcast that is coming out of, well, the Bella Center, right here where the climate talks are taking place. Our guests right now are Wahu Kara. She is a Kenyan global justice activist, and Bill McKibben, co-founder and director of 350.org. But I want to return to a minute walking in the hall yesterday. I had a chance to speak with Decima Williams from Grenada. She's the chair of the Alliance of Small Island Nations. She's the Grenadian ambassador.
What Grenada needs, and what the 40 members of the small island states that are in the EOSIS Alliance, what we need is the recommitments under the Kyoto Protocol, the second commitment period, because in that we will be given the commitments on targets to reduce global warming and targets to fund it, that to correct the damage and to preempt further damage. We need a legally binding outcome that holds these countries in the Annex I, the major industrial economies, who have been principally responsible for this damage to the atmosphere and to the planet. We need them to continue to take their responsibility for another period after 2012.
That is Decima Williams. She is the spokesperson here for the Alliance of Small Island Nations. She's the chair of that group. You also spoke along with them at a news conference, Bill McKibben. Why is this group so important?
Look, Amy, the last time we talked was right before this big day of action we had in October, which turned out to be, as CNN said, the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history, 5,200 demonstrations in 181 nations. That's what allows, to a large degree, people like Decima Williams to have a platform now. There's finally a global movement around this world behind climate change in every country. And so they're able to stand up and stand up for the science. I mean, in this hall, it's people from Africa and from the small island nations that are the ones standing up for what we know the science is. It's the Americans, to a large degree, most of the other developed nations, trying to duck what we know the science says. That's why she's so important, and it's why this mix of inside and outside is so important. Mm.
Wahukara, can you talk about how you went from working on issues of debt in a developing country in Kenya to where Obama's father comes from, President Obama's father, to climate debt and what that means?
Both economic debts and climate debts, which is ecological debt, is very, very connected because as we got into indebtedness of financial or economic debt, it is also reflected on how the environment was also plundered. And like in Kenya, for example, many of the many projects like the World Bank funded and created debts in making big dams, those dams compounded the problem of the climate. And in order to engage for justice, and justice in a comprehensive mindset, we must see both economic and ecological debt on where they interface and how they are related, so that when we are addressing the issue, we are able to address the issue with a very concrete manifestation in really stating what the problem is. And that's why debt and climate are one and the same question as far as justice is concerned.
Explain how you experience climate change in Kenya.
Well, even before the debates of climate justice started, many of the Kenyan people began to witness and to recognize and to state how seasons are changing, how they cannot follow the pattern that they have been used as far as when to plant and how to plant, which is a very, very important aspect of our lives because we are predominantly agricultural people. And ordinary people would say, well, we don't know what is happening. And I would really want to quote one mother who said, I think there is something that the North are doing because the sun no longer behaves the same way. So if an ordinary mother can say so, she's expressing issues that the scientists also write so intensely and in a very mystified manner. So the whole question of climate is real. The droughts, which have also the effect on no food, and therefore people are dying. And in particular this year, Kenya has experienced a very, very drastic drought, and people, animals have died. Lakes are drying up. We have a whole lake, a fresh lake, Lake Elementaita, which has totally dried out, which has affected the ecosystem of nature, like the birds, the flamingos, birds. So the whole question of climate change is connected to the source of livelihood.
What about snow in Kilimanjaro?
It's already melted. So, and even in Mount Kenya, the snow is melted. And people observe these things and express. And what is so important is that ordinary people do discuss and talk of how nature has changed and they are looking as to why has nature changed. So it is very easy to introduce climate justice debate to the ordinary people because they already have the agenda as a debate. They only need to understand what are the scientific argument that is already given in matters of how we have utilized our own environment, especially in relation to the fossil fuels and greenhouse gas emissions. And as I speak, even now, the greatest concern for people is how they can reclaim the traditional knowledge that they know in matters of how they guarantee their livelihoods as far as seeds and management of the soils is concerned. And they are saying, we want the soil, not the fertilizers. Mm. I've heard many of them saying so. Meaning they don't want the intensive agriculture way of growing crops. They want subsistence, which is connected to them.
You know, interestingly, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger just held a news conference right outside our window. And he said that this summit is as a result of grassroots movements. And Bill McKibben, I wanted to go there for 1 minute before we move to Alberta, to the tar sands. The issue of 1.5 to survive, it's a mantra around here, what people are saying, 1.5 degrees Celsius. Explain that, what the limits are.
350 and 1.5 have become the two numbers that define this conference, and they're always linked. We need 350 parts per million CO2. If we start moving in that direction, there's some chance we'll be able to limit temperature increases to 1.5 degrees. That's not good news. We'll raise temperature 1 degree already, and that's melted the Arctic. We don't want to go any further, but there's enough momentum to take us there. That's right. This is desperation time. And it's not being treated that way by the United States and the other big powers. It's being treated precisely that way by the most vulnerable countries. And they are finally pointing out that they're in a fight for nothing short of survival. When Mohamed Nasheed, the president of the Maldives, addressed this big roaring audience yesterday at the big 350 rally, he kept saying, these are the three most important words you will ever hear, 350, because for us that means survival. That's what people in every corner of the world, in October and then last weekend, when we had 3,000 vigils around the world with people spelling out those numbers in candles all over the planet, that's the point people are trying to get across.
I want to thank you both for being with us. I want to thank Bill McKibben, co-founder and director of 350.org, and Wahu Kara. She is a Kenyan global justice activist. Your group's People's Movement for Climate Change, why you're here right now. And back in Kenya, it is, your organization is?
Kenya Debt Relief Network.
The Kenya Debt Relief Network. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. This is Climate Countdown. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper doesn't arrive for the climate talks until later this week, but Canada's already become the target of a series of protests here in Copenhagen over its climate record. John Hamilton filed this report.
I'm very pleased to announce that Canada pledges reductions targets of 40% below 1990 levels by 2020 and 80% by 2050.
The news was almost too good to be true. In a video statement on the website EnviroCanada, one of the world's top industrial polluters pledged bold action on climate change and reparations for the climate debt owed to poor countries. In another statement posted to the site, a Ugandan climate delegate welcomed the news.
This is the day that will define our century. Canada is fully acknowledging its historical climate debt and the legal responsibility that follow.
But as it turned out, this news was too good to be true. The announcements were part of an elaborate hoax by a group called Climate Debt Agents, with the help of activist pranksters, the Yes Men. In reality, Canada has abandoned its pledges to reduce emissions. After coming to power in 2006, Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper led his country to withdraw from its commitments under the Kyoto Protocol.
We started by asking ourselves some hard-headed questions, like what are realistic emissions reductions targets for Canada, and how exactly will we achieve them?
Harper's rejection of carbon emissions reductions has a lot to do with the Alberta tar sands. The western province is home to one of the world's largest reserves of bitumen, a mixture of earth and petroleum that requires vast amounts of water to extract, and which consumes enough energy to keep Canada from fulfilling any plan to cut emissions.
All of the easily exploitable large pools of so-called of oil, of so-called light sweet crude, have probably been discovered. The oil industry will be forced to look harder, dig deeper, and spend more to find crude oil that will be ever more difficult to refine.
I say climate, you say criminal. Climate.
Alberta's tar sands have drawn widespread protest and civil disobedience from environmentalists, like Greenpeace activists who temporarily halted production at a Suncor tar sands mine in Fort McMurray, Alberta, last September.
The message we want to send today through our actions is that real climate leaders don't buy tar sands. We're taking action today because we need to send a strong message to world leaders that they need to reach a binding agreement in December at Copenhagen that will not only see an end to projects like Suncor's tar sands projects and other tar sands projects, but also to put the brakes on catastrophic climate change.
As climate delegates met across town at the Bella Center, a protest led by Indigenous peoples of Canada outside the Canadian embassy. Ariel Derringer is a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation and a campaigner with Rainforest Action Network.
I'm here today because I want to emphasize the importance of shutting down the Alberta tar sands because it is the most destructive industrial project on the planet. It is destroying my community, my family, in the community of Fort Chipewyan are dying of cancer. The rivers and the lakes are poisoned. It is my people that are paying the price of a select few that get to profit off of our lives, off of our culture. The Alberta tar sands are not only destroying my people and my land, but they are creating the largest CO2 emissions from one single project in the world. Instead of decreasing the emissions in Alberta, we are increasing them at the cost of my family, my community, my culture, my way of life is being destroyed. For what? For oil? For what? For the profit of Canadian governments and corporations? For financial institutions that are making billions of dollars off the backs of my people?
A 2009 study by Edmonton's Cross Cancer Institute found that cancer rates in First Nations communities downstream from the tar sands were 30% higher than expected. Francois Paulette is an elder spokesman with Smith's Landing First Nation.
Where I come from, it's a beautiful land. I come from 160 miles downriver of the tar sands. I'm affected. I'm affected by what is happening in the tar sands. Oil is money. Water is life. And water is being destroyed right before our eyes on our river. I just want to say the Prime Minister of Canada, Mr. Harper, the representative and representative of the oil industry and capital of the oil industry in Calgary, that you are killing our river. That you are killing our way of life.
Some of Canada's leading environmentalists and activists who've traveled to Copenhagen for climate talks joined Tuesday's demonstration. Among them, journalist and author Naomi Klein and Maude Barlow, chair of the Council of Canadians and co-founder of the Blue Planet Project.
It's very important that we show our solidarity with the First Nations people here, that they're not alone, they're not alone back in Canada, and they're not alone here. And what we really want to say is that Canada is clearly taking a terrible position here in Kyoto, in Copenhagen, having dumped the Kyoto Protocol and committed to way less than we should have for the simple reason that they will not deal with the tar sands. The tar sands, the oily footprints of the tar sands are all over Copenhagen. Everybody's talking about it. It's not the United States that's the outlaw. It's not China that's the outlaw. It's Canada.
We've heard again and again about what a destructive role the United States is playing in these negotiations. But the real truth is that the the most destructive force inside the Bella Center is our government, is the Canadian government. Because at least the Bush administration didn't sign the Kyoto Protocol. And the Obama administration says they won't sign the Kyoto Protocol because they won't follow it. Our government signed the Kyoto Protocol and then made a mockery of international law.
First Nations activists here say those international laws include treaty obligations to communities whose lands have been decimated by Alberta's tar sands. With Prime Minister Harper due to arrive here later this week, Ariel Derringer presented a representative of the Canadian Embassy with a basket full of demands for Canada's government.
We just wanted to deliver this basket to Stephen Harper.
Okay.
So if you could pass this on when he comes to town, that would be fantastic.
Okay.
Would you like me to go over what's inside?
Okay, that's fine.
We handed it off to a delegate from the Canadian Embassy to pass off to Stephen Harper when he arrives in Copenhagen later this week. And inside the basket were copies of the treaties that are being violated by the Alberta tar sands, or by the Canada's tar sands, rather, and copies of the Kyoto Protocol, which he signed on to, as well as a copy of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, to remind him that there is something else that he needs to sign on to in order to really fully respect Indigenous people's rights and to move forward in a comprehensive way with climate change negotiations.
For Democracy Now!, I'm John Hamilton in Copenhagen.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. This is Climate Countdown. We are live in Copenhagen. When we come back, a debate on cap and trade. Stay with us. Paddington Bear Blue, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. This is Climate Countdown. I'm Amy Goodman. At the heart of the Obama administration's effort to reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions is a market-based system to trade carbon, known as a cap and trade. The system sets carbon emissions limits of companies and doles out allowances that can be bought and sold to meet the emission targets. In Washington, the House approved a cap and trade system earlier this year as part of the Waxman-Markey bill. The Senate's considering adopting a similar provision in the Boxer-Kerry bill. But the issue of cap and trade has split the environmental and progressive movements. Last week, in the pages of the New York Times, NASA scientist James Hansen published a piece called Cap and Fade. He argued carbon trading will do little to slow global warming or reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. Hansen went on to say cap and trade will allow polluters and Wall Street traders to fleece the public out of billions of dollars. Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman responded by describing cap and trade as the only form of action we have to take against greenhouse gas emissions before catastrophe becomes inevitable. In a moment, we'll host a debate on the subject, but first I want to turn to a new animated film that premiered here in Copenhagen, or at least it was played here. It's called The Story of Cap and Trade. It's directed by Annie Leonard, who's best known for her web video, The Story of Stuff.
So how does cap and trade work? Well, pretty much all serious scientists agree that we need to reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere to 350 parts per million if we want to avoid climate disaster. In the U.S., that means reducing our emissions by 80%, maybe even more, by 2050. 80%! Now, the problem is that most of our global economy runs on burning fossil fuels, which releases carbon. the factories that make all our stuff, the ships and trucks that carry it around the world, our cars and buildings and appliances, and just about everything. So how are we going to reduce carbon 80% and not go back to living like Little House on the Prairie? Well, these cap-and-trade guys are saying that a new carbon stock market is the best way to get it done. The first step would be getting governments around the world to agree on a yearly limit on carbon emissions. That's the cap. I think that part is great. So how do they want to ensure that carbon emissions stay under the cap? Well, governments would distribute a certain amount of permits to pollute. Every year, there would be fewer and fewer permits as we follow the cap to our goal. Innovative companies will get on board, building clean alternatives and getting more efficient. As permits get scarcer, they would also become more valuable. So naturally, companies who have extra will want to sell them to companies who need them. That's where the trading comes in. The logic is that as long as we stay under the cap, it doesn't matter who pollutes and who innovates. We'll meet our climate deadline, avoiding catastrophe, and oh yeah, these guys take their fee as they broker this multi-trillion dollar carbon racket, I mean market. Save the planet, get rich, what's not to like? Some of my friends who really care about our future support cap and trade. A lot of environmental groups that I respect do too. They know it's not a perfect solution and they don't love the idea of turning our planet's future over to these guys, but they think it's an important first step and that it's better than nothing. I'm not so sure. And I'm not the only one.
An excerpt from the online short, The Story of Cap and Trade by Annie Leonard. We'll link to the full video on our website. We're joined now by two guests. Larry Lohman is the author of the book Carbon Trading, A Critical Conversation on Climate Change, Privatization, and Power. He works at the British non-governmental organization, NGO, called The Corner House. We're also joined by Frank Ackerman. He's an economist at the Stockholm Environment Institute. He's part of Tufts University, author of Can We Afford the Future? Economics for a Warming World. The story of cap and trade that Annie Leonard did is very critical of cap and trade. Professor Leonard, you are for cap and trade. Or Professor Ackerman, you're for cap and trade. Explain why, and do it in basic terms. You're used to teaching students. Think of us as all your students.
I'm not exactly for it. I don't think either Hansen or Krugman got it right. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. It's certainly not the only thing that we need. There's undoubtedly a role for having a price on carbon, which can be done either through a tax or through cap and trade. The big mistake in this debate, I think, is to pretend that a price on carbon is all that we need. Anytime a price incentive like this has worked, it has needed many, many other things to be working with it. The image of a level playing field that economists sometimes suggest is exactly wrong. We need to be doing everything we can to tilt the playing field in the direction we want it to go. Then a price, either through cap and trade or through a tax, might actually make it a little easier. But it, no chance at all. It'll do the job alone.
Larry Lohman, you're opposed to cap and trade, so you feel strongly about this. Why?
For some of the same reasons, actually, that Frank was referring to. I agree completely with Frank that there's no magic bullet in terms of a carbon price which is going to solve the climate problem. What we need is massive reinvestment away from fossil fuels, instead of putting subsidies into fossil fuels, putting them into renewable energy. We need to overcome our addiction to fossil fuels in industrialized societies. And the problem with cap and trade is that it stands in the way of doing that in many ways. It's a way of providing pollution rights to some of the worst polluters so that they can delay the kind of structural change that's necessary.
Explain how that works.
Well, it happens in a number of ways. First of all, the cap and trade proper is a system by which those who are unable or do not want to reinvest in the long term away from fossil fuels. I'm talking about big industries like electricity generators, highly dependent on fossil fuels, chemicals, steel, cement, and so forth. Instead of investing in structural change away from their dependence on fossil fuels, they can simply buy pollution credits or pollution rights from other sources. Now, there are two sources of pollution rights they can buy to keep doing business as usual. One of those sources is to buy pollution rights from other companies in the same country who have reduced their emissions beyond the requirements, and they have extra pollution rights to sell. Another and very dangerous source of pollution rights that they can buy in order to continue business as usual is from so-called carbon offset projects instituted abroad. For example, you might invest in a tree plantation, which supposedly absorbs your pollution abroad, and that enables you to continue business as usual. The problem with this is that it enables enables industrialized countries to continue their addiction to fossil fuels.
I wanted to go to this issue of carbon offsets and then get Frank Ackerman's response and play another clip from Annie Leonard's online video called The Story of Cap and Trade.
Devil number two is called offsetting. Offset permits are created when a company supposedly removes or reduces carbon. They then get a permit, which can be sold to a polluter who wants permission to emit more carbon. In theory, one activity offsets the other. The danger with offsets is it's very hard to guarantee that real carbon is being removed to create the permit, yet these permits are worth real money. This creates a very dangerous incentive to create false offsets, to cheat. Now, in some cases, cheating isn't the end of the world. But in this case, it is. And already there's a lot of cheating going on. Like in Indonesia, Sinar Mas Corporation cut down indigenous forests, causing major ecological and cultural destruction. Then they took the wasteland they created and planted palm oil trees. Guess what they can get for it? Yep, offset permits. Carbon out? No. Carbon in? You bet. Companies can even earn offsets for not doing anything at all. Like operators of a polluting factory can claim they were planning to expand 200%, but reduce the plans to expand only 100%. For that meaningless claim, they get offset permits. Permits that they can sell to someone else to make more pollution. That is so stupid. The list of scams go on, and many of the worst ones happen in the so-called third world, where big business does whatever it wants to whomever it wants. And with lax standards and regulations on offsets, they can get permits for just about anything.
That is Annie Leonard's story of cap and trade. Frank Ackerman, are you concerned about this?
Sure. I think any policy can be done well or badly, and there's plenty of reason to worry about the U.S. doing things badly in this area. The three things I can think of you could do wrong with cap and trade is you could give a fixed cap that doesn't go down. That was the problem with the sulfur emissions cap and trade in the 90s, that there was a fixed cap guaranteed forever instead of a declining cap.
And that was particularly related to acid rain.
Exactly. That was the poster child for the success of cap and trade. It's always quoted. That was a big mistake in that case. That's the one mistake that I think we have made progress on, that the Waxman-Markey, all those bills, have a declining cap. Problem number two, where we don't get nearly as good a grade, is giving away the allowances to the incumbent polluters. If you give away allowances to the companies which are already emitting pollution, you give a huge transfer of wealth to the people who were already causing the problem. The sulfur trading in the 90s did that. Waxman-Markey mostly does that with sort of gradually phasing it out. The much superior alternative of auctioning the permits so that the money returns to the public to be used for environmental purposes, for income redistribution, for whatever. What's been advocated, the Cantwell bill that was mentioned earlier.
Which is sort of being called cap and dividend.
The cap and dividend idea returns the money to the taxpayers rather than giving it to the original polluters. So Waxman-Markey and those bills start out giving most of it to polluters with a promise that it'll gradually decline. And the third big problem is the offsets. That has happened. What the film described has happened with a lot of offsets. On the other hand, if they were verified, if you actually did honestly prove that somebody else had reduced carbon somewhere else, what's wrong with that? Carbon is completely fungible. It's the same commodity. You emit carbon in Brazil, Bangladesh, Boston, it doesn't matter. It's the same carbon in the atmosphere. So if you can confirm that you honestly did reduce it in Brazil or Bangladesh or Boston, it's the same reduction. The question of dishonesty in the offsets is obviously a real problem.
Well, Larry Lohman, what about that?
I agree that dishonesty is rife throughout the carbon offset market. I mean, our experience in the Durban Group for Climate Justice and studying dozens of these carbon offset projects around the world in countries like Uganda, India, Indonesia, Philippines, Brazil, and so forth, is that this is just a universal aspect of carbon offset projects. I think the problem goes a bit deeper, though, and that is that actually it's not possible to distinguish between fraud and non-fraud in this market. It's not possible to prove that you're actually saving carbon. I mean, the example from Annie Leonard's film, I think, shows this, where the factory owner simply says, well, I was planning on expanding 200%, but now I'm telling you that I'm going to expand only 100%, and therefore I'm saving 100%. Therefore, I should be allowed to sell pollution rights to the industrialized countries in the north so that they can continue business as usual. Obviously, there's no way of verifying the claim of the factory owner, whether that was going to be business as usual or not. The consultants who come into this system to make that claim actually can say pretty much anything they want to and claim that they're making any carbon savings they want to. So I would go a little bit further than Frank in saying that the system is not only open to abuse, the abuses cannot be corrected even in principle.
I wanted to ask you, Larry Lohman, about a figure that's being thrown around here, 17%, that the U.S. is pushing for a 17% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Explain.
Well, I think that that claim has been flying around, but there are two really misleading things about that claim. First of all, under the Kyoto Protocol, for example, emissions reductions are generally reckoned from 1990 levels. So under the Kyoto Protocol—
So for the rest of the world, they're using 1990 standards.
That's the conventional baseline year. So, the question is, by 2020, how much are you reducing from your 1990 levels? Uh-huh. The U.S. is being a little slippery by saying, okay, well, actually, we're reducing 17%, but what they don't mention is they're reducing that from not 1990 levels, but from 2000 and 2005 levels.
And Frank Ackerman, the equivalent in 1990 terms of 17%?
I think it's something like 4%.
So it's actually 4%. And Larry Lohman, is it actually even cutting 4%?
No, it's actually worse than that. Even the 4% figure is misleading because those 4% of reductions probably would not be made within the United States itself. In other words, the fossil fuel polluters in the United States would continue business as usual. What they would do instead would be buy pollution rights from outside the country, from these carbon offset projects outside the country. I think the International Rivers Organization in Berkeley has calculated that actually, under the Waxman-Markey bill, the U.S. would not have to reduce its own fossil fuel emissions until 2026 under the Waxman-Markey provisions.
Frank Ackerman.
I think there are all kinds of things that ought to be fixed. Certainly offsets should be limited. But the problem is that the debate about setting a price on carbon has been set up as cap and trade versus tax. And we've had 30 years of teaching Americans to froth at the mouth when taxes are mentioned. And so there's no chance whatsoever that a carbon tax will be passed. I think some of the big companies that are advocating a carbon tax are probably conscious of that and doing it with dishonest intent in the attempt to destroy the entire idea of climate legislation. From that, I deduce that, sadly enough, we'll have to figure out how to patch up the holes in cap and trade, of which there are many. There are a lot of things to patch up.
What if the carbon market collapses?
I could tell the world how to reduce carbon emissions. People seem even more allergic to the idea of command and control. The problem is not describing how to reduce American carbon emissions. The problem is creating incentives that will make people feel like they have been allowed to do it in a free market way. It's the inefficiency of making this all happen through the market rather than simply saying, we're not going to drive cars like that. We're not going to waste electricity like that. It'd be very easy to tell people how to reduce emissions, but if you want to do it through the market so people make choices, you have to set a carbon price.
Goldman Sachs have a big role here, Larry Lohman?
I'm afraid so. In fact, just last month, J.P. Morgan, another firm like Goldman Sachs, actually bought one of the biggest carbon offset consultancy and accumulator firms, EcoSecurities. And I think that indicates the interest of Wall Street in getting into this market so that they can speculate, so that they can make money out of it.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Larry Lohman, researcher at the NGO The Corner House. He's based in Britain, editor of the book Carbon Trading, A Critical Conversation on Climate Change. And Frank Ackerman. He is an economist at the Stockholm Environment Institute at Tufts University. His book, Can We Afford the Future? Economics for a Warming World. And that does it for our broadcast. We are broadcasting live from Copenhagen, this exclusive two-week series called Climate Countdown. Please tell your friends. Go to our website at democracynow.org, where our headlines are available, all of our transcripts of all the shows and our video and audio podcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Roberto Caduce, Aaron Mate, Angeli Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood. I have a very happy birthday to Nicole Salazar. A special thanks to Becca Staley, Nick Gilla, Julie Crosby, Karen Renucci, Brenda Murad, Miriam Bernard, and Dennis Moynihan. On Friday night, I'll be here in Copenhagen speaking at the Studentenhaus in the Norsport area. You can go to our website and get the details. Our website, again, is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman, live from Copenhagen.